Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thanks a lot for tuning in, wherever you are in the UK and the rest of the world. Before we get going, if it's okay with you, I just want to thank all of you who subscribe to the Patreon version of Rock and Roll Politics, where you get all kinds of things like Rock and Roll Politics mugs, but crucially and centrally, bonus podcast each month. And the one for March will be arriving in the next few days. And on the Patreon Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative grouping, we're looking at Labour as they built up to a big election victory in 1997, based on interviews I did as political editor of the New Statesman with all the players in that era. And we've already looked at an interview I did with Claire Short, which was explosive and insurrectionary. And yet she remained in the shadow cabinet and then the cabinet until she resigned of her own volition. And another one from Peter Mandelson that was exuberant and in its own way fairly revealing and candid. And in the next few days, if you subscribe, and obviously we compare with now the differences and parallels and so on. And this week, I'll be looking at an interview I did with Tony Blair in the summer of 1996, less than a year to go before he became Prime Minister in a landslide parliament. So please subscribe. It helps keep the whole thing going with the legendary podmasters and Simon, the producer, and so on. So, yeah, that would be great. And it's fun. And I'm planning for April. I'll have to liaise with podmasters about this. Another of our live sessions with the Patreon Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative. But more of that to come anon. Anyway, I know you'll be really busy. I don't know if any of you have seen the Channel 4 documentary on Boris Johnson. It got me thinking again about character and politics. The documentary highlights, I mean, it's interesting to me on lots of levels. It highlights the limits of television documentary as a form of delving deep. It doesn't delve deep at all. And yes, it devotes a lot of time to each episode. The first episode is well over an hour. I think it might be 90 minutes. And there are a lot of episodes. The others aren't as long as that. But, I mean, the BBC in its modern, confused tabloid form would not allow a series to run for more than half an hour per episode and not that many episodes. So it lets it breathe. It has some good interviews with people who haven't been interviewed before. It has some interesting footage of Boris Johnson. It roots quite a lot of his character in his upbringing and his parents in ways that are interesting. But of course, it can't explore why he ended up where he ended up, why Brexit took the form it did in any detail. There's no exploration of the Brexit he took. There is obviously about his role in Brexit. There's no exploration of his pitch in December 2019, that cakeism pitch of building hospitals, spending on this, spending on social care, and yet at the same time wanting to cut taxes and pledging not to put certain ones up and all the things that went on in that cakeist, no analytical stuff on that. There's obviously a bit about Cummings, but no analysis about what the fallout was beyond Cummings' sort of megalomania. So it was shallow, and yet you thought afterwards a bit more about the character of Johnson, a complex figure, not just a bumbling rogue, not just a performer, but clearly someone troubled and quite a few of the interviewees say disturbed, actually, and they relate that to the past. How significant is character? I pose the question, it's interesting, we used to do, you know, when we studied Shakespeare, I loved studying Shakespeare. And one of the favourite themes, and it was a question posed in, you know, exams, in Shakespeare's tragedies, Character is Destiny discuss? And it was a brilliant question because, of course, character plays a part, but a character is part of a much wider structure as constructed by the playwright who plays God. And so context matters. You know, Macbeth, the fate of Macbeth was partly determined by the context in which he functioned. So it's not just about character, and yet clearly character is central to Shakespeare's tragedies and plays an important part in politics. The history of the UK in recent times would have been different, I think, certainly without the character of Thatcher. I don't think Thatcherism was inevitable in the 80s. France, Germany, the United States, although Reaganism was, you know, obviously there were some echoes, but some European countries took a very different turn. It was partly character. And similarly, though by no means fundamentally, it was partly the characters of Heath, Wilson and Callahan that explains what happened in the 70s. By no means the only factor, the context, both domestic and internationally, and the past all played their parts, as they did in Shakespeare's tragedies. But I was thinking, obviously now, about the immediate. And, oh, by the way, another example is very interesting. The character of John Smith and the character of Tony Blair were very different. And John Smith would have been a very different prime minister to Tony Blair, but not wholly so because of context, the past of the Labour Party and all the other factors. So with Keir Starmer, if you remember a few podcasts ago, the serialisation of Tom Baldwin's biography included a very interesting interview with Angela Rayner, which we explored on the podcast, where Angela Rayner said Keir Starmer was the least political person she knew in politics. Extraordinary statement, the leader of the Labour Party, almost certainly the next Prime Minister, the least political person she knew. And it highlighted to me, so I came away from the Johnson documentary in a way more intrigued by the complexities of his character. I hasten to add, in many ways, he's a shallow buffoon, but there are some layers there. Anyway, I've been thinking a lot about that episode we did as a cooperative on Angela Rayner's quote. And I was away when the book was published, but listened to a few, Tom Baldwin did quite a few interviews, and I listened to them and they were interesting. And a lot of the focus was on Keir Starmer's backstory, his upbringing, which was tough, his relationship with his parents, the mother who was ill, the father who was a pretty distant figure to him. And there was much sadness in that account of that time. And it partly explains, I think, his commitment to workers' rights and so on, which will go into that manifesto, will not be a subject, I think, of any great significant U-turn between now and the election and so on. But I am interested in this idea of him not being political, because on one level, it is just absurd to make the observation, although it is widely made, not just Angela Rayner. Here is someone who was right at the top of the legal profession, had been director of public prosecutions, who decided to switch to politics relatively late in his career. Now, that's a very political decision to go into politics, suggests a fascination with politics, a commitment to politics as a vocation. And by any reckoning, he has been, in the short period he has been a politician, a hugely successful one, whether you like him, agree with him, disagree with him, don't like him. He got into the shadow cabinet very well. First of all, he got a safe seat to dream of, a dream seat. Yeah, who would not give a lot for that seat? He got it. It was Frank Dobson's seat, huge Labour majority. Then he quickly got into the shadow cabinet. He got, in a way, a thorny but high-profile brief of Brexit. And he became leader of the party and now looks as if he's going to lead that party to an historic election victory. Is that not the sequence of a highly political figure? And yet you can see why the argument is made that in a Labour Party, which is full of deeply politically motivated figures, not least those who he has tended to move towards in recent times, the right of the Labour Party, which is as energetic and determined and resolute as any on the so-called hard left of the Labour Party. And yet he seems to kind of navigate those factions without paying any reference to the points in which those factions were formed and are defined, etc. Anyway, this is a prelude to me saying that I was away when the book was published, but I listened to some of the interviews. But I wanted to speak to Tom Baldwin on behalf of all of us, because I thought there was more to explore. And in particular, from his perspective, you see, because Tom Baldwin is in a very interesting position. He is a friend of Alistair Campbell's and, like me, followed the sort of Blair-Brown era very, very closely. He was mainly a correspondent, political editor, not a columnist as I was. But he got a lot of scoops and he knew him and was very close to Alistair Campbell. So he knew that period and saw it close up as a journalist. Then he became Ed Miliband's press secretary. So saw one leader day in, day out, and had to work out how to project that leader to the wider media. And a leader who, in my view, is, you know, very different to a Keir Starmer type of leader. And that's one of the things I wanted to speak to him about, Tom Baldwin. And then he got to know Keir Starmer initially on the basis that he would write the book in Keir Starmer's name. So he would do a load of interviews and all the rest of it, but write it and go out in Keir Starmer's name. But then it changed to this biography. So he has been in a position to follow closely the character, the context, and with that sense of history from playing different roles in the Labour Party or about the Labour Party for many decades. And I thought that kind of context meant there was more light shown. I didn't ask Tom about the childhood and the things that you've probably heard in other interviews. But I think we go in a different direction, and he said it was different. He's probably done 200 of these. But anyway, I got back the other day, caught up with him, and this is how our conversation began. And then at the end, I'll pop back with some reflections on the budget and assembly notices, etc. So stay tuned. But here is our conversation, which I think shines light on all elements, New Labour, the Miliband era, and of course, the character and the context of Starmer. Character is destiny. Discuss.
Tom Baldwin, you've spoken a lot about your book to various outlets. I want to begin by asking you a slightly different question. You have followed Labour leaders very closely, probably more closely than any other journalist I know. You worked for Ed Miliband. You knew Tony Blair well. You're good friends with Alistair Campbell. And now you've written this book on Keir Starmer. I just want to ask you about the difference between Ed Miliband and Keir Starmer. It seems to me Ed Miliband was an openly ideological politician. He was excited by ideas, and your job was to project that to us lot in the media. Keir Starmer is almost unrecognizably different, would you say, in that respect?
I think that's probably too hard a statement. And so much of this book is actually about nuances and ambiguities rather than clean dividing lines. So I don't think it's fair to say Keir is yin to Ed's yang. They have similarities. I think they're both in politics for the right reasons. They both have a progressive instinct. They also kind of have slightly unusual political styles. I mean, I spent a long time trying to persuade Ed to sort of embrace his geek in a geek and say, look, you know, I am different to David Cameron and I'm not, you know, trying to sort of do it through photo opportunities. Ed was always a bit reluctant with that idea, but I think that was actually the best way to sell Ed. Whereas Keir, I think, is instinctively unpolitical. And that's where the real difference is. Ed grew up in politics. I mean, people who knew the Milibands when they were growing up say it's actually quite natural for Ed to stand against David for the leadership. I mean, if you knew them as teenagers, that was almost what you would have predicted. And, you know, they had, you know, Terry Kelly and Ken Livingstone around a breakfast table. Whereas Keir, yeah, he grew up in a political household. His dad was very political, Guardian reading, socialist, and mum was a socialist. But his life wasn't politics. He wasn't a special advisor. He says even now he doesn't know which members of the shadow cabinet were Blairites or Brownites. He doesn't really care. And so he doesn't have this background of the party and policy formulation and ideology, which I think many people in politics do have.
Now, this is what I want to pursue, because in a way, what you've just said is extraordinary, because you and I could tell him who comes from that Blairite background, who comes from the Brownite background, who doesn't but has other origins.
You can spot the difference by what they wear.
You can spot the difference by what they wear. And we could also tell him what the implications of their background are for now. Is he genuinely not bothered about any of that?
Again, it's not quite unbothered. It's he doesn't always get it. And, you know, I was going to call the book The Unpolitician at one point. Turned out wasn't actually a word. I thought inventing a word for the title of a political biography might be a bit a high risk. But he isn't just one thing. I mean, yeah, I was looking at the title of Tony Blair's biographies, The Modernizer. You could say it in one word.
Yeah.
And he's not just one thing. That's why in the end you end up with a kind of catch-all title, The Biography. And not getting politics is actually a strength as well as a weakness. It means he can move from A to B much faster without the baggage, without all the ideology, without all the friendships you're worried about upsetting this person or that person. Just does it. But as Angela Rayner says, for the leader of the Labour Party, it's quite weird not being a very political person. And a lot of politics is about building factions. It's about understanding how to reach compromise and what makes people tick. And Keir doesn't like those sort of meetings. He likes meetings with a piece of paper and a decision, and a lot of the process of politics, which consumes so many millions of hours, he doesn't see, he thinks it's a bit of a waste of time.
Let's look at an area where this could be a disadvantage, and then we'll look at where, I mean, he's leading a party with this huge poll lead, so there are clearly advantages in his approach. But he said in his party conference speech in the last autumn, that the next government, and I think he's right about this, faces the challenges combined of 45, 64 and 97. So he sort of knows that there is this epic challenge. But here's the advantage of being political. You can make a judgment about why there is such a big challenge after 14 years of Tory rule and what needs to be done. And then you have a huge debate about what needs to be done. But if you haven't got that kind of political imagination, are you going to be able to rise to that task of 40? You know, there are advantages of saying, right, this is why we're in this state. It needs an epic response, and this is it. But if it's all kind of what's right, what's wrong, and incremental, there are problems, aren't there?
There are, and he talks about this decade of national renewal. He puts particular emphasis on the word national because he says the whole country has to come together and get behind these missions if we're going to achieve it, a bit like Britain was during COVID. And to do that, you think perhaps a leader needs this sort of performative side to inspire people with this big idea. We're all coming together behind this idea. And right now, I think it's probably true that most people in the country don't know what Labour's five missions are. They certainly don't know that they're part of the delivery system and that he's relying on them to help deliver this. But I do think we're going into a different era where the big, grandiose idea isn't taken seriously and is part of the problem that politics has got. So often we've seen someone promise something big and transformative, whether it's Brexit, austerity, or even modernisation, and then it hasn't really changed their life. And that adds to the cynicism about politics. Because, you know, these big ideas, they require heroes and villains. They require dividing lines. Those are our friends. Those are our enemies. I don't think that's the kind of politician that Keir Starmer is.
And yet you've said in some of the interviews you've given, and it's a good phrase, there's a radical programme hidden in clear sight. And actually, when you step back and look at the policies, I think some people will be quite surprised if they implement them. However, it's a bit of a sort of hodgepodge. Policy development is the hardest bit of leadership, I think. I don't know whether you found that working with Ed Miliband. So he's got this big program on employment rights, which probably speaks to his backstory, which you've spoken a lot about, his father and so on. Then you've got public ownership of one thing, energy. Does that mean he's a fan of public ownership?
And railways.
And the railways, of course. But then other things dumped. So, you know, how does it come together? Is he, and you've said the missions are the big thing that we should all look at. Well, how did they come together? What, I mean, you were following him as these policies were being developed and framed, although I think the framing is still missing a bit. Mm. But what has driven all of this? Is he a fan of public ownership? Is he not? Is he, you know, where does it all fit together?
I mean, the answer on public ownership is he's a fan of it to the extent that it works. So it's becoming radical for pragmatic reasons, whereas usually you have a radical idea and then you're forced to become pragmatic. And he goes into this completely the other way around. What works? What works? If that's not working, then I'll try something else. And it becomes progressively more radical as he goes through options. And that's why defining him by a single policy, like £28 billion, is very un-Starmerish. You referred earlier to his conference speech last year, where he said, are we meeting the challenge of 1945 or 1964 or 1997? And his answer at the end is all three.
All three, yeah.
And that's so Starmerish in that the why I know precisely why he's asked that question, because people like Peter Mandelson had gone around saying, what you can define those victorious Labour oppositions in one sentence. You know, Clement Attlee stood for public ownership of major services and industries. You know, Harold Wilson stood for the white heat of technology and harnessing of that. Tony Blair stood for the modernization of Britain. And Starmer stubbornly refuses a single sentence definition. He defies it. And to say, which one do you want? I'm picking all three, is so typical of him, but it reflects the complexities of the time. And yeah, we've had Dominic Cummings and his three-word slogans. How's that working out for us?
Yeah.
Really, is it working to have politics defined in three words? Or do you actually want politics which is hard to define? Because this country is hard to govern and the solutions are going to be hard to find.
One of the fascinating things is that on one level, it's even sounds daft to pose the question about how strong he is as a public figure, because he's developed huge strengths. I mean, Neil Kinnock is in awe about how he has taken control of the Labour Party in a short period of time. It took Neil Kinnock great stress and much longer to do it. But at the same time, and this is, you're absolutely right, he's nuanced and complicated. He backed down on the 28 billion, even though they're 20 plus points ahead in the polls. When they didn't win the by-election in Boris Johnson's seat, he immediately distanced himself from the Sadiq Khan EULA's policy because it was unpopular in the by-election. And that seems to me to be a sign of sort of weakness as well as the strengths, which are clear and impressive.
he would say he's not backed down on the green mission, you know, clean energy by 2030. Hasn't blinked on that at all. He's looking at different ways of getting there. And £28 billion isn't a mission. Don't have a mission to spend £28 billion. That's nonsense. It's not a policy. It's just a big number. In fact, if you look at some of the programs, you know, they hadn't really developed enough policies to spend £28 billion. You know, it wasn't all shovel ready. So how you get to a destination is what matters to Starmer, rather than being defined by one particular route. So he will try perhaps 1,000 different policies to get towards a mission, most of which won't be very exciting, most of which won't make many column inches in newspapers, but may actually work better than these big, grandiose ideas that do. And it's a very different way of doing politics, and I think it goes to the heart of his success. To bring radical change to the Labour Party at the speed with which he has, while simultaneously being seen as a bit dull, reassuringly dull, might actually be a bit of a superpower.
It is interesting, the dullness, isn't it? Because he's not, is he? I mean, he's a fascinating figure, and that there has been huge interest in your book, which shows, I mean, if he was completely boring, you wouldn't have been doing this big media round. And again, it is complex, isn't it? That compared to just about any other leader I can remember, there are sort of opposites. So he hates it, but interviewers with that characteristic machismo say, "Are you boring?" I mean, ridiculous question. So some people think he's boring.
And he hates the tag. He really resents it.
Of course he does. It's deeply offensive. But there he is, one of the few leaders who genuinely loves football, who's had this incredible background that you talk about, who, you know, learnt the piano with Fatboy Slim. I mean, it is. So again, how to explain this sort of counter, you know, oh, he's dull, he's too dull for politics. And yet a life that has been just extraordinary and a character who clearly is driven and has been a success at everything he has sought to do in the law. He gets to director of public prosecution in the Labour Party. He's only been there for 10 seconds. He ends up leader. And yet people think he's boring.
It's interesting. I mean, there's these two characters in a book. One is Boris Johnson, who is literally the opposite of him. You know, he's a show-off. He's a bullshitter. He doesn't respect people. He doesn't respect rules and systems. Another character is from his legal career, a guy called Ben Emmerson, who for a period was opposite him in the Doughty Street Chambers. His office was literally opposite. And he was everything that Keir Starmer wasn't as a lawyer. He was a brilliant jury trial lawyer. He's flamboyant. He was, you know, the loudest person in the parties. And they had a rivalry, really deep rivalry. And there's something about the relentless, dour, roundhead Keir Starmer versus these more cavalier figures. And he is, somebody said to me once, he was good with the judges, not the juries. He would win his cases on narrow points of fact in an unflamboyant way. The judges adored him. He's not showing off to the jury. He's not, you know, posturing, talking about the facts. And I think that's the style he has as a politician still, really. And throughout his time as leader, everyone's been saying, this won't work. You've got to have more charisma. You've got to have these three-word slogans. You've got to have a single big vision. Really? He's the one 20 points to the lead. And it's not an accident.
Yeah.
It's not just because the Tories have been so appalling.
I mean, probably of all the, I don't know whether you call yourself an author or a journalist now, but of all the kind of
both.
Political... Both. Yeah, I do as well.
It's ambiguous. But, yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah, it sounds grander as well. I always say political journalist and author. You know the team better than the rest of us lot. And there is a lot of speculation about the team around Keir Starmer at every level, in the media, in the shadow cabinet. Now, I said at the beginning, you are good friends with Alistair Campbell, and you and I follow the kind of Blair operation very closely. You did the media for Ed Miliband and worked with his team. Some people say the team is underpowered, not ready for the task ahead, certainly in government, and that there are divisions. Now, you've been working closely with that team, and you got an on-the-record interview with Sue Gray, which was fascinating, and she remains a fascinating figure in this dynamic. What's your impression of all that? Clichés, inevitable in the build-up to an election, people slag off the team? Or what did you see in terms of its readiness for what is still the biggest ascent to come, the election, and then, if the polls are right, government?
The first thing to say is that every leader of the Labour Party's office I've ever seen, including the one I worked in, had divisions. It gets slagged off. It's always seen as a bit distant and remote. Its physical location in Parliament is remote. There are always divisions within it. There were divisions. I mean, people think of 1997 as some sort of Camelot.
Yeah,
and they were sitting around the right round table. Yeah, there were furious battles there. Yeah. I mean, I once wrote a story when I was a journalist rather than an author about how the two most important women in his team, Angie Hunter and Sally Morgan, were fighting like rats in a sack. Alastair Campbell then made them walk up and down the seafront together in Bournemouth with photographers to prove my story was wrong. And they were swearing at each other under their breath the whole way. So look, the idea that these divisions are new is for the birds. Some of the tension is necessary and creative. There should be tension between people preparing a transition plan for power and a campaign. And you need to battle it out because the campaign will want to promise the eye-catching stuff and the people transitioning to power will want to make sure they can actually do it when they get there. That's a discussion that needs to be had. You can't just paper over that and pretend those tensions don't exist. They're necessary both to win an election and to be an effective government. Are they ready? Well, I'm very wary of criticising a leader of the Labour Party's office, which has done so much and done it so well when I didn't do it, when I was in the leader of the Labour Party's office. And I think it's pretty invidious for me, who was part of a team that lost a general election, to criticise a team that appears to be on the cusp of winning one. What I would say is they've got to get ready for a big bump in the road, because I think it's almost nailed on certain that it's going to happen. The media want to change the narrative. The Tory party want to change the narrative. There's some people in the Labour Party want to change the narrative. And so when there is a wobble, they need to rehearse what they're going to do and get ready for that. And I've seen a couple of instances lately. I think there was a wobble around the Rochdale by-election and the original selection of a candidate, which shows flaws in that system, and then the decision-making process about getting rid of Aziz. I think there was a wobble around Israel-Gaza, and I was surprised by how fast a mistake turned into catastrophizing and panic.
Being the LBC interview on Gaza.
And, you know, Keir should have corrected it faster, but you know, this wasn't about sending troops into Iraq. It was about expressing an opinion on something which was happening. You know, nothing the Labour Party said or did was going to save a single life. But the speed with which that turned into a semi-crisis did concern me. And I think it raises questions about how they handle these crises. And not, you know, or stop problems becoming crises.
Yeah, yeah. And finally, the book's out now. Have you spoken to him about it? You said he was quite wary of some of it. He, of course, as you said, stopped it being a book by him that you were helping to write. Have you had a talk with him about it since he's presumably read it all now?
He's so far, touch wood, been pleased with it. I haven't written the book so that he's pleased with it. I was saying in the introduction he won't like every word, and I don't think he did. I think he found it very raw having to talk so much about his family. I think he was pretty wary about so many of the people around him talking so much about his leadership of the Labour Party. He found that quite difficult, and he thought it was a risk. And he did say one thing to me, which he says he learned a bit about himself.
Ah, that's interesting.
He's not someone who in life has been prone to self-analysis. He sort of gets on and does it. And this has been a process of having to reflect on who he is. I think it's actually made it better for... He's got better at harnessing what he calls the backstory to his front story, explaining who he is to voters. I think it has served a purpose in explaining him, sometimes warts and all, to voters. And I think it's actually quite good for someone like him who's pretty buttoned up to be forced to, I mean, probably good for anybody, but particularly someone who's going to go through the eviscerating experience of an election campaign where a Tory party desperate to cling to power. And also, if he wins, go into government when so much pressure is going to be piled on him. I mean, it's pretty good for him to have a clear account for himself about who he is, what his motives are, and why he's there, and how he's got there.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? He said he learned about himself from your book. Do you think when he told you, I don't want to do it in my name, so to speak, he was unsure of his public voice and therefore couldn't really face the idea of the book, Keir Starmer by Keir Starmer kind of thing, appearing?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of boastfulness which he doesn't like in other people. He felt uncomfortable being that sort of politician. He feels uncomfortable with so many aspects of politics. And he just didn't want to put it all out there. He didn't want to expose his family to it. He didn't want... why other political leaders don't do this. Why am I doing this? I'm not that sort of person. And I liked him for it. You know, even though quite a lot of work had gone into the autobiography, I actually liked the humility in him, which said, I don't want to have 300 pages by me saying how great I am.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that humility is still... I mean, if they win big, it's quite intoxicating, isn't it? Now, the polls might all be wrong, and this doesn't happen. But do you think if they win a landslide, that humility is absolutely built in to his character? Or are you expecting Keir Starmer to evolve as a figure in power?
Both. People constantly change, and one of his chief characteristics is learning. You know, he and some politicians double down on their errors and reinforce their worst characteristics. When he becomes aware of a deficiency, he'll move to correct it. That's partly why the book exists. He knew that he wasn't getting his story across. And even though it was extremely painful for him and he didn't like the process, he recognized there was a need to get it out and therefore cooperated with this book. I don't think he's someone who's going to let it all go to his head. From what the conversation I have with him, he is more aware than anybody of just what a grim inheritance it will be, how hard it will be to get anything done. And that's what goes back to these missions. They're not really meant to be a big retail offer. They're a governing mechanism. They're a sorting mechanism. Mm. Is it mission critical? You'll ask. Then he'll be interested. Mm. If it isn't, then we do not have the time or the money to do it. And so there'll be lots of things, lots of competing priorities, lots of decisions. And the missions is how he'll determine which he can focus on in that first term and which he will not be able to do. And he's, you know, he's steeling himself for government rather than think it's going to be the sunlit uplands.
Yeah, he's right. I mean, he's older than Harold Wilson was when he retired in 76, looking ancient, stooped by the burdens of power. Mm. And he's got it all to come.
And he's actually got experience of running big government department. Yeah. And that's, I mean, I don't think enough attention has been paid to that. I mean, every few weeks, a Sunday newspaper journalist gets briefed with the idea that Tories have got some dossier drawn up by Andrew Gilligan about, you know, his record at the Crown Prosecution Service. But there's something, I think it'd be much more interesting to look at. You've got a guy who's never run anything more than an office with five staff, becomes director of public prosecution. Suddenly he's got 8,000 staff in a time of austerity where he's being asked to make cuts. And he reforms a public service. He goes around the country, he talks to all the different members of the staff that he's got in different regional offices. And I think most interestingly, when the institution he's running comes under challenge, he steps back and says, is the challenge right? And he doesn't always defend it or circle the wagons around the institution. So there's actually quite a big record of running something in government and reforming something in government, which hasn't, you know, everyone's obsessed with Jimmy Savile or, you know, this particular case or that particular case. There's actually a much bigger record which people who want to know how he would be in Downing Street can learn quite a lot from.
Well, Tom Baldwin, thank you very much. It's a fascinating book. And as we imply in the second part of our conversation, if you do the sequel, that will be fascinating too. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
So there we are. That was my conversation with Tom Baldwin. I recommend the book. It's very well written, and it is written with great sensitivity and broad sympathy, but there is a balance to it. It's not a hagiography, which would have been anyway undermining of both subject and author. And of course, the big challenges in some respects are still to come. The election campaign, and then of course, government. It remains really interesting, I think, this thing that Keir Starmer will be older than Harold Wilson if he becomes Prime Minister, when Harold Wilson resigned as Prime Minister in 1974. Wilson was just 60 when he resigned. So, yeah, well, of course, we talked about that in our discussion. Anyway, look, before you go, by the way, if it's okay with you, I'm not going to do questions this week, but there are some brilliant ones, and they're all ready to go. But there's a lot on, and so they will appear. So keep them coming in. Our never-ending debate and discussion. SteveRick14@iCloud.com. But just a couple of thoughts. Isn't it interesting, again, with the budget? There is an understandable mythology around tax and spend, that tax cuts are always popular, that Labour cannot ever engage in a grown-up, candid way about tax and spend in an election, or else it is doomed to lose. And yet, here we are, with a second tax cut, and the combined tax cuts of these national insurance cuts, 4p, that's a big tax cut. And it has made no difference whatsoever to the standing of the Tory party. And I wonder whether there is a mythology around tax cuts. For sure, in 1987, the Tories added up all Labour's spending plans and said Labour's plans don't add up, and won big. Although there were many other reasons why the Tories won big in 87. And for sure, we had that kind of all-defining 1992 tax bombshell election, which Labour lost and the Tories won against expectation. But there we have it, you know, this 4p tax cut and nothing. And, you know, there are other examples when Gordon Brown and some in Tony Blair's number 10 thought it was going to lose in the election. But when Gordon Brown put up national insurance for a sort of earmarked payment to the National Health Service, I think the idea of hypothecation, earmarked taxes, is so important. Polls were taken to show it to be the most popular budget since polls began measuring the support or otherwise for budgets. Voters could see the need for the tax rise to pay for urgent improvements to the NHS. They might most of the time want both tax cuts and good public services.
But if the link between a rise and the outcome in terms of service quality is made, they will buy it. And when they navigate Britain now in all its appalling dysfunctionality, I can see why they're not excited by a 4p cut in national insurance. It's so obviously not the priority when the public services are in the state they're in. So I think that is interesting from the budget. The public spending projections on public services are horrifying for after the election. They make George Osborne's austerity era seem profligate. And how that is navigated by whoever wins that election is the big question hovering around British politics, but will be unanswered because a grown-up tax and spend debate before an election, as we've discussed here many times, is impossible. I think the fact that Hunt has stolen the non-dom tax is a problem. It's not a practical problem. It was never going to raise that much money, but it was Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer's tax and spend shield before the election, following Gordon Brown's clever way in which he, before 1997, proposed a couple of popular tax rises like the tax on the privatised utilities, who had made a killing. And it was a popular tax, and non-doms was a popular tax. And that shield has gone. And while it is removed, there is a fleeting vulnerability, probably fleeting. And this is new. It didn't happen in 97 that the Tories nicked Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's protective tax and spend shield. The shield has been nicked at this attempt at emulation. And they will clearly find fairly quickly an alternative spending route. But, you know, I kind of wonder, and I admit this is much easier for us lot to wonder in the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative than if you're facing an election as leader and shadow chancellor. But I just wonder if they said the 2p tax insurance cut was not their priority and they were going to continue to spend the non-dom tax on health. Whether they would be slaughtered, I don't know. Maybe they would, but all the evidence suggests not. But I can understand why they're not taking that risk. The bigger issue for Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves is what they do if and when they've won. Those spending projections are unsustainable. And if a Labour government were to implement them, it would be a very short-lived Labour government, even if they got a majority of 450 or whatever polls are currently predicting. So I think the budget, which was kind of dismissed as a damp squib, is not without significance. And we will see how things are played out in the coming days. Labour, I'm told, are still working as if there may be a May election called, getting everything ready for the short campaign, if and when such a date is ever announced. I continue to think, I always have, that it will be the autumn, but we will see. And in the meantime, I'm doing a lot of kind of live events in the coming days. On Wednesday, the Rope Tackle Art Centre in Shoreham. And then on Saturday, I'll be speaking at the York Book Festival at St. Peter's School in York. And the tickets for both of those will be on the blurb with the podcast or at the relevant websites, the York Book Festival and the Rope Tackle. And then on March the 26th, live at King's Place for the first time this year. And the one at Shoreham and the one in King's Place will be the first of the pre-election specials, where we'll be delving deep, and you can get tickets for the King's Place one at the King's Place website or with the blurb for this podcast. So I hope to see you there, because I mean, yeah, there's a lot going on and we need to make sense of it all. But thank you very much. Sorry not to do the questions. They were brilliant as ever. You maybe have a more extended question time soon, but have a great week. There's a lot going on, and I hope to see some of you at the two live events this week at the Rope Tackle on the South Coast or in York for the book festival, where I'll be speaking, answering questions, and then signing books so we can get together. All right, thanks very much. Take care. See you all soon. Bye.